Welcome to Coin Talk. Another week, more coins. I'm Aaron Lammer, to be joined shortly by my co-host, Jay Kang. We are brought to you in partnership with Medium. Thanks to Medium. You can find all of our episodes at medium.com/cointalk. You can also find Medium's crypto landing page and me.dm/crypto. Lots of great reading there. I have been actually trying to keep up and failing. There's just too much happening. Hopefully, Jay can help explain it all to me. If you want to get in touch, you can send us an email at hi@cointalk.show. All right, here's the show.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Monday, February 19th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $11,159.
Welcome to Coin Talk. We are recording this on President's Day. We're back in the crypto cave. Aaron, how are you doing this
morning? It's a crypto holiday out here.
Yes, who would be the president of Bitcoin?
Who would be the president of Bitcoin? I mean, I think it depends whether you're like, believe in like the founding fathers, in which case it would be like Roger Ver, maybe. or if you're more of a like, bring on the crypto party of today. I don't know who would be a modern Bitcoin leader.
Well, I was thinking about it this morning and I was like, all right, let's say that hyper Bitcoinalization happens, yeah. Right? And the world economy flips to Bitcoin.
I'll say we usually define terms on this, but I've never heard the term hyper Bitcoinalization. I think Jay just coined it, so he'll have to find it.
No, I did not
himself.
Coin it. Oh. It is when Bitcoin hits a point where it accelerates all the way towards the world economy being shifted towards Bitcoin.
Oh, okay.
I believe. Once again, as we said last episode, part of this show is you and I using terms incorrectly.
Okay, so let me just try and understand it here. The flippening were it to occur would be when another currency passed Bitcoin and became the dominant cryptocurrency. The hyper Bitcoinization point is when Bitcoin flippens the world.
Yes, and when like the world basically relents and says, we give in,
yes.
Crypto is the new future.
Yes. Bow down to my feudal lords.
At that point, there needs to be a holiday for someone's birthday where we get off. Now, the obvious one would be Satoshi, but since we don't know who it is, we have no idea what
I think
his
it would probably be
is.
White Paper Day, like whatever day the white paper was published. And that would be a day which we take off from the American school system so students could study the white paper.
In that world, would it be like the world under Mao in which everyone has to learn the same poems? Do you feel like children would have to recite parts of the white paper?
If what you're saying is that certain no-coiners like Adrian Chen would get sent to work camps, the answer is yes.
Okay. Anyway, so we have a lot of news to discuss today.
A lot of news.
The first thing that I think that everyone was talking about was this thing that was going around Reddit, got picked up by a lot of people, including sort of the no coin media, which always hates Bitcoin and is against us at all times.
Yeah, fake news. Which, the fake no coin media.
Which is that Coinbase had sort of a catastrophic day.
Oh, man, this was going to be my news item.
Oh, okay. Why don't you explain to the listeners what happened?
So one of my first experiences in crypto was like going on Reddit and following like all of the crypto Reddits. And if you follow like the Coinbase Reddit or the Gemini Reddit, you see people all the time complaining, oh, my deposit didn't work. They lost my money. So when this stuff starts popping up, you don't really know whether it's real or not. So people started reporting massive bank withdrawals from their bank accounts to Coinbase, like $50,000.
Yeah, like all the money that
like
you have.
Like more money than they had ever bought in Bitcoin, additionally being bought by just with like drawn out from Coinbase.
Part of crypto, I think, but part of the, I guess, car crash element of reading these threads is that anytime a cryptocurrency crashes or something like BitConnect happens where it turns out to be a scam, there are all these messages where the headline is like, I am dead fucking broke.
Yes.
I don't know what to do. And so this happened again.
Due to this cryptocurrency event.
So that started happening with Coinbase saying like, yo, Coinbase, I only meant to buy $500 of Bitcoin. You took out $50,000. I have no money. I can't pay any of my bills this month. What the fuck is going on?
And I will say, for people who haven't used Coinbase, part of the way that the Coinbase system works is you authorize in with your bank account, at which point you are allowed to make transfers to Coinbase. But after you've made that transfer, you don't deauthorize your bank account. Coinbase just sort of keeps your bank account. And there's a gentleman's agreement that they won't just randomly withdraw the entire contents of your bank. Jay, this is how hyper-Bitcoinization is going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
All of these exchanges are just going to start sucking out bank accounts.
Yeah, and say that actually you only have that money in Bitcoin and you can't reverse it.
So
I guess,
I mean, it would be better. You should just go live in the Bitcoin world now. All your money is already there.
Well, all right. So this one ended up being true.
Yes.
For a lot of users, their bank accounts were being overcharged by Coinbase.
Yeah, I think also just randomly charged even. Like some of these people I don't think were even making buys at all. They just randomly transferred a bunch of money to Coinbase.
All right, so Aaron, when you saw this news, how long did it take you for you to go to your own bank account and be like, holy shit, I hope this did not happen?
Still haven't looked.
Oh, really? Why? How have you not looked? It took me like 8 seconds.
This is probably like the differences in our personality.
What type of personality is like, this service that I have used several times now might have drained my entire bank account, but I'm not going to check because...
Well, okay, wait a minute. People did actually get Bitcoins from
No.
Oh, well, see, if I had known I wasn't going to get Bitcoins, I would have checked.
Okay, so let me clarify this for the...
Should I check on air?
let me clarify this for the listeners then. In your mind, you were saying, oh, as long as that money is spent to buy more Bitcoin, I'm okay with it.
I could come out on top of that situation.
Yeah, so you're basically looking for an excuse for all the money that you have in cash in the world to be converted to Bitcoin. And that way you could explain to your wife, hey, it's not my fault.
Yes.
Coinbase took all of our money and now it's in Bitcoin.
Well, you know like how sometimes there's a foul in sports and you can play advantage and do the follow through? I guess I was thinking if they drained my bank account and Bitcoin went up, I would just be like, ka-ching. And if Bitcoin went down, I'd be like, I didn't make that buy. Like, refund my money.
So it would be like...
I was thinking I might play it.
So it would actually be sort of a hedged bet that you felt like you were making at
that point. Yeah, I feel like it's almost like a freebie. It's like if there's a lane violation on a free throw on the other team, just shoot the free throw. If it goes in, you get the free throw.
Okay, so like, you know how Tom Brady can sometimes pull the guy outside and he just throws the ball 50 yards in the air.
Exactly.
That's how you thought it was.
That was how I was thinking about it. Okay, my money's still there.
All right, so you did not get hit with it. It turns out that this was not Coinbase's fault.
Yes.
That this was Visa's fault. That Visa had some sort of processing error. And that Visa comes out and apologizes and very clearly says, this is not Coinbase's fault, right? Yes. So it is some sort of horrific clerical error that happens. It actually had been going on for a while, you know, and that's the most shocking part to me.
Yeah.
And the only part where I can say that Coinbase has some culpability in it is that at some point, Coinbase should probably notice that this is happening.
I would think so.
But they don't because, you know, Coinbase just... It is infamous for a reason. All these messages on Reddit are there for a reason. It's because they actually are horrible at customer support.
I think that Coinbase would have noticed if Coinbase was randomly sending money out to bank accounts. Yeah. It's a little strange that they didn't notice that money was flowing in.
See, that's my hedged bet. You know, that's my Tom Brady throws a ball 50 yards in the air. Is if the money came into my account, not if it left.
I mean, we don't know how much money this is, but even if it was, you know, just sitting there for a while and they refunded it, Coinbase probably made a lot of money. Like I was reading an article in Bloomberg, Max Chafkin wrote an article about Robinhood. You know, Robinhood is like no fees, all this stuff. And the way that they pay for it is they're just sitting on a bunch of your cash. And you can make money by having a bunch of cash in any currency.
So they're just getting bank interest?
I think it's probably a better yield than just bank interest, but they're using the huge sum of cash they have to make money.
The question that I had that came out of this, which is, you know, it seems to be resolved right now. Coinbase has not had a win in a very long time.
Sure.
And there are other competing platforms that are coming out. 3 months ago, when we were doing our basement tapes, or even at the launch of the show, if I had said to you, Aaron, do you think that Coinbase's dominance is ever going to be tested in the next 3 months? I think both of us would have said absolutely not.
I think that's correct.
Were we wrong? Is Coinbase starting to show some cracks?
Well, I mean, look, this is like the fifth time we've asked whether Coinbase is starting to show some cracks, so I think that's a pretty definite sign of cracks. There's a couple things I think are fascinating about it. One, it's like the story of the American startup over the last couple of years, that the greatest threat is not competition, but implosion. Uber didn't get beat by Lyft. Uber just really like ruined a lot of its goodwill.
Yeah.
I think Coinbase is, I wouldn't say that there's like a dominant competitor to Coinbase right now. There's a lot of people who could become that, but mostly Coinbase has dragged itself into the mud. on a secondary level that's a little more sympathetic to Coinbase, I think people now want crypto to operate interchangeably with the way a bank operates or a credit card company. And a big part of that, how that works, is if someone steals your credit card, they'll deal with it. They'll wheel it back. They'll put the money back in your wallet. And that's part of the service you're getting that you're, you know, paying a fee to a bank or credit card for. And people want crypto to work that way, but crypto is specifically designed to not work that way. The main idea of why we have a commonly held ledger is you can't wheel it back and move the money around. And I think we're starting to see all of the weird situations created by that. There was a story in the Times today by Nathaniel Popper about people getting robbed for Bitcoin. Why does this happen? Because you can't wheel it back. You don't see people robbing people and telling them to drain their bank account in the same way, because the banks have a way to just remedy that.
Yeah.
Maybe Coinbase is experiencing the growing pain that everyone's going to experience first.
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, in Japan, where obviously crypto is a little bit more mature, there are solutions that are trying to come out where a crypto bank would just operate like a regular bank, and that it would give you all the protections that you would have. And I think that as some of those solutions get taken to fruition and then migrate over the United States, that maybe that's when Coinbase's dominance will start to falter. So, for example, BitFlyer, which is a huge Japanese exchange, is coming to the United States. I think those are the actual threats to Coinbase, is competition from abroad. Domestically, it's harder for me to see.
I have one more thing that I was thinking about on that sort of like protection front, which is, it's always fine if you lose a little bit of money or you screw up a little bit, because these companies are rich. They can afford to cover a small amount. But if someone really screws up, like when there was the DAO hack that resulted in Ethereum Classic, there's going to be a too big to fail point where if someone screws up badly enough, they're going to try to not fix it by covering the loss, but trying to wheel back the loss in the blockchain ledger. And that's where the first big fork of Ethereum happened. And I predict that as more people try to guarantor crypto funds, there's going to be an additional pressure to wheel back catastrophic losses on the ledger.
Yeah, and at that point, then we're not really even dealing with the same thing.
Which is why some people don't support Ethereum now.
Number two news item, which is the Telegram ICO. I think this is something we haven't talked about yet. It is dominant news.
No, we have talked a lot on Telegram.
Yes. Telegram, which is a secure messaging app, essentially created by two Russian guys who I think no longer live in Russia.
Full of crypto nerds.
Has done an ICO, and they have raised $800 million so far.
Is it an ICO, or is it some kind of a weird pre-ICO?
It is a pre-ICO before the ICO. And so,
what does that mean? Did you understand?
Well,
what
there's a pre-sale to an ICO, which is sort of like a, you know, friends and family type round of investment. And this actually led to all sorts of problems within the Telegram ICO itself, in that like people were saying, hey, I have a backdoor to the Telegram ICO. Just send me your Bitcoin. I'll send you the preferred shares that you're not going to get, and they were all scams, you know.
So, as I understand it, I think the token's called TON.
TON, which is for the Telegram Open Network.
Okay, so I don't think we've really talked about ICOs much yet on the show. ICO, for people listening, stands for initial coin offering. And on a basic level, a company like Telegram that wants to do an ICO and raise funds issues a bunch of tokens. Those tokens both represent some kind of ownership stake in the company and also potentially are going to be used in the economy of Telegram.
Or, I mean, it depends. Some of them have zero ownership stake in the company. I mean, I think that some securities-based ICOs, you get some sort of imaginary or like very, very opaque and difficult to discern ownership, quote unquote, in the company. With this Telegram ICO, it's also very unclear. But it's basically, they're putting it out saying, like, we need to raise money. We want it to kind of be like WhatsApp, where it's a dominant worldwide used secure messaging system. But we also want to build a layer in which there's sort of this open network where you can build crypto apps. You can build all sorts of stuff on top of it. Yeah. And so the coin, which is called Gram, I think, is the thing that they're selling right now. And they've raised a ton of money.
What's the difference between Gram and ton?
Ton is the network. Is what it's called, the TON.
This is kind of a good test case because it contains all of the confusing elements all together. So the other thing about ICOs that I didn't realize until I had sort of followed a couple of them is that not everyone buys at the same rate. So the very, very, very early people, they'll say, hey, you're the really early people. You can get a 95% discount. Then the second pool gets an 80% discount.
Yeah.
And this leads to all kinds of corruption.
Yeah.
It leads to all kinds of scammy behavior. And it leads people to say, hey, I have access to the 95% off ICO round. How about I buy some for you and I'll sell them to you for 85% off, which is still better than you're going to get on the open market when these actually hit a point when you can buy them.
Yeah, it really feels like what it was called bonus whoring and online poker, where at some level you just get a certain amount back for what you invested. And it feels like, you know, like the way that they advertise it and market these things honestly just feels like scammy in itself. They're like, if you invest today, yeah, you get 20% more coins. You're just like, what are you building here? You know, like, what are you trying to do? So
it's kind of unfortunate for Telegram because most of these are vaporware. Telegram's actually a pretty good app. Like, I kind of do believe in Telegram.
All right. Well, so the question that has been brought up by almost everyone in the Bitcoin community about this Telegram ICO, and I would say that generally the mood is skeptical, despite the fact that they did raise $800 million. So how skeptical can it be? Essentially, what this is it's a loan to the people who are starting Telegram so that they can build these things, right?
Yes.
So that they're basically saying, look, we had to use our own money to start Telegram. We're out of it, and we need money to take this thing to the next level.
I mean, it's not even like they used their own money. They just used their original round of investors' money to build.
No. They invested their own money into the first round of Telegram. And so they're saying, like, look, we need your help to take Telegram worldwide. And to build layers on top of it.
Is it really a loan? I mean, it's never going to get paid back.
Well, it gets paid back as, I guess, Telegram, the company, appreciates and as this economy grows more robust
and
1 gram token is worth more. Like, that's the pitch that they're giving.
Got it. Okay.
Right. All right. So one of the people who, this is pure rumor, is that Roman Abramovich, who is a friend of Jared and Ivanka's, also the owner of Chelsea Football Club, he apparently has invested $300 million of it. Again, nobody knows if this is true or not, but that is a rumor out there. This is going to be the biggest ICO of all time.
Is that the projection?
I mean, it already is. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So my question to you about it is, if you were given the ability to invest in this, would you invest in it?
Gram or ton?
Would you invest in the overall Telegram ICO project?
The Ton Gram project.
The Gram Ton, yeah.
Yes.
You would. Why?
I mean, compared to some of the like poo-poo that is currently in my portfolio, I mean, Telegram works really well. We use it.
Working well is very debatable. So like William Turton, who I work with at Vice News, who is a very young and smart and capable young reporter. When he was at Gizmodo, he reported on Telegram. Basically said Telegram, of all the secure messaging apps, including iMessage, is by far the worst because at that point you had to sort of turn on encryption. And so the encryption wasn't fail safe. And that if you talk to cryptologists, they'll say that essentially WhatsApp's encryption is much better than Telegram's.
I mean, like, you know, WhatsApp is like a giant, extremely valuable company that's owned by Facebook now. So I'm not really comparing it against the messaging market. I'm comparing it against like Sumo coin and proof of stake wallet.
So that's also a very telling detail, which is like, listen, I own some real shit and this is less shit.
It's got an edge because it seems to have already captured the crypto market.
That is so true. And I do talk all day on Telegram.
And we're in all of these Telegram channels with all sorts of other crypto nerds.
Yes.
So I'm not invested in it because I'm like, yo, it's good, the absolute winner in the messaging wars. I just think it's worth investing in even as an entrant. You know, we talked in the last episode about privacy coins, and I was like, hey, I actually see a use case for these. I think these could actually work. Another thing that I think could actually work is using crypto payments on top of a messaging app, which is very dominant in Asia as a way to handle mobile payments, is you have like a chat app that you can also buy stuff with.
Yeah.
So if there's someone who's going to take a real shot at doing that with their own coin, that seems like realistic to me.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to list some of the problems with it.
Shocking.
The first is what I said, that Telegram's encryption is not as
also kind of similar to Monero, actually, and Zcash, where we're saying like the transactions aren't actually anonymous unless you force them to be.
Yeah.
Telegram isn't actually encrypted unless you force it to be.
The second thing is that Eric Wall, who is a writer at Bitcoin.com, which is, I guess, a controversial site because of its ties to the Bitcoin Cash community. I think that's right.
Yes.
Wrote a tweet where he said that he had read the Telegram ICO. It's 100% pre-mined, centrally issued, unbounded supply, sharding shitcoin. He says it's one of the worst white papers he's ever read, and that it's full of blockchain armchair guessing, which, you know, whatever. That's all of crypto. And baseless estimates. But the part that I wanted to ask you about is the 100% pre-mined. I know that you hate 100% pre-mined.
Yeah, that did give me pause. I mean, that puts it more of in a Ripple kind of position, which kind of makes sense because they're both companies that have their own coin that works on their own coin network. In Ripple's case, the Ripple Corporation. In Telegram's case, Telegram and the Telegram app. And yeah, that does give me pause, but it's not really very surprising. You wouldn't really expect Telegram to put out a totally decentralized mineable coin.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you there because what they're trying to do is create an economy and they want to create it as fast as possible.
I mean, we're getting kind of far away from decentralization here, honestly.
Yeah.
Once we start talking about
this. I guess it's
this.
Very bad for the Satoshi acolytes.
Yeah. It's getting into more like startup investing territory with the like ICO as the only part that really connects it to crypto.
Number three, and I want to know how you react to this news.
Yep.
Telegram got pulled off Apple's App Store for a while, right? Because people are using it to trade child pornography. It is, like a lot of crypto, a den of bad activity, right?
I was not aware of that, but...
terrorism cells use Telegram. Money laundering discussions happen in Telegram. Drug markets use Telegram, right? So basically all the dark markets don't use WhatsApp because I think they're probably afraid of centralization and the link to Facebook. They don't know what Facebook is doing, or the little that they know about what Facebook reveals to the government gives them some pause. It is as shady of a messaging app as you can get. Now, does that make you...
I don't think you've ever seen Kick, if you think that's true.
No, I think Telegram is shadier than Kick. Does that make you more bullish or less bullish on the Gram ICO? Because I want to remind you of the conversation that we've been having about our proposed money laundering ETF and how we would both really invest in the money laundering ETF.
So are you saying is Gram and Ton held in the money laundering ETF? I'd say yes.
Yes. And so does that make you more or less bullish on it?
More.
Me too. That's the only convincing argument. Not obviously, look, we as a show are opposed to all these things, but in terms of money laundering, pure money laundering and drug markets, that actually makes it a use case. That actually makes it interesting to invest in as a anarchic, more or less human being. Now, obviously, like, you know, given you don't want to really invest in things that support these things, but I think if you want to make a case for the value going up, maybe that's the case that you would make.
Let me give you a use case that is not involved money laundering. I want to send you some crypto, pay for dinner that we had in Bitcoin. We have to go through this elaborate dance where I'm like, what is your Bitcoin address? Okay, yeah. Now I'm doing a send, just wait an extremely long time and check the blockchain to see whether this has gone through. Whereas me and you are already linked up on Telegram. On Telegram, I just like type in the amount, it's off. Having some sort of an identity and messaging layer does make a lot of sense to me. Am I happy that I have to use a completely different currency to get that? That seems dubious, but I'm pretty bullish on this idea of payments and messaging all being put together into one product.
Why could they not just build a layer to send Bitcoin in the same way?
I think that people are probably like, that is a, you know, some of the stuff we saw in Korea. What's the Korean chat?
Kakao Talk
wanted to create a whole exchange within it. So I think we'll see all of that. But I wonder, you know, if Lightning is one new layer on Bitcoin that allows it to be routed more quickly, will there be another layer that allows you to move interchangeably, shape-shift, changely style between currencies where if you send someone Gram, it does a quick translation, pulls out of your Bitcoin wallet, turns it into Gram, sends it, switches it back into Bitcoin. Like, we may start seeing these kind of swappy transactions where a coin like Gram might only be like the translation layer. I don't know. This is all pretty speculative.
Yeah. And I would just say, as long as we're speculating, I would rather just speculate on Bitcoin being the major form of exchange without having to buy Gram. But at the same time, I don't know if somebody was like, hey, you can get in on the ground floor here with a gram/ton ICO.
Yeah.
I would probably send them a little bit of my money.
Yeah, agreed.
All right. So should we get to our guest?
Yeah.
So our guest today is Maria Bastias. She is working on another ICO, but the Civil Project, which is, you know, close to our worlds. It is a journalism project that is trying to change the way that journalism payments happen, that journalism itself works through the blockchain. Is that right?
I'll let her explain it, but that sounds pretty close. And Maria is someone who I knew as a writer far before I knew her as a ICO-er. And she's a great writer. She used to do a lot of pieces for The Awl. She's the kind of person I have never like known exactly what she was up to. She would not have been someone I would expect to be like doing an ICO, but I don't know who I would expect would do an ICO. So good for her.
Knowing Maria a little bit, when I lived in LA, I met her a couple of times. I will say that she is kind of always on the front edge of interesting things in a way that you're just like, oh, well, this person has an actual life outside of most journalists who just live inside the journalism world, tweet all day, and like get mad at other journalists. Maria actually has interests.
Well, this will be good because we can actually talk to someone who's doing an ICO and see if our assumptions about how ICOs work are correct and perhaps decide whether we want to put our money into Civil or Tungram.
Tungram. All right.
All right, let's give her a call. Welcome. Hey, Maria Bastias.
Hi, gentlemen.
Great to talk to you.
You too. I'm thrilled to be here.
So I actually heard you talk about your project Civil last week at Postlight. Check out me appearing on their Track Changes podcast talking about Coin Talk. All sorts of inter-promotion going here. But when someone asks you who knows a little bit about crypto but nothing about Civil itself, what it is, what's your elevator explanation?
Well, I tell people that this is a project that uses the blockchain to ensure integrity in journalism. And if you're interested in immutable archives, if you're interested in changing the economy of journalism and in making it more difficult for sort of Cambridge's Analytica or bad actors in Russia or trolls or weirdos of various descriptions and agendas to interfere with what gets printed with your information, you'll be interested in this project.
Okay, so how does that work? Because all that sounds great, but how does the blockchain sort of solve some of those problems that are happening?
Okay, so I've been writing about Bitcoin and crypto in general since like 2013, when I first wrote a piece for the New Yorker blog. And at that point, after talking with these sort of early pioneers of crypto, it became evident to me that the important thing about this technology wasn't the currency part of it. It's the incorruptible information part of it. Like really, that's all it is. All that blockchain technology does is produce a means of making information incorruptible and unfalsifiable on a distributed basis. So you don't have to go to the government to figure out like, you know, whose driver's license is this or whatever. You could make any kind of network to guarantee that something happened, whatever kind of human event you want, a contract or whatever. And I think anybody who understands a little bit about distributed networks or peer-to-peer technology can kind of imagine this, because we've all seen like, you know, sort of Mastodon and other sort of attempts to create distributed networks for producing all kinds of different information. But the important thing that Satoshi did is make a fail-safe system for verifying that information outside the need, you know, sort of absent the need for a trust and authority. So if we have the capacity to make networks of any kind to guarantee the integrity of information, I mean, obviously that's of interest to us as journalists, right?
Sure.
So that's kind of where my thinking started. And I was sort of interested in that concept, you know, all the way back years ago, but there was no kind of way of instantiating it, you know. And I was looking, I mean, you know, I contacted people at the Digital Currency Initiative at MIT and all kinds of other places to try to figure out how to do this. At some point last summer, Josh Benson, who's formerly of Capital New York, gave me a buzz and said, look, you know, we're making a blockchain-based publishing platform and we think you might be interested in it. I'm like, oh, hell no. Please sit down. I'm going to tell you exactly what we're going to do. I mean, I was just so excited about this because I've been thinking about it for years, right? Like, to give a quick example on the archive scene, Popula, my publication, and, you know, any of the other ones on Civil, and there's going to be like over a dozen by the time we launch, I think, can create archives and publish them to the Civil network. And they'll always be there. They cannot be removed. You have to shut the internet off to remove those archives. So no matter what happens later, like I always tell people, we're returning to the age of microfiche. When you go to the library, even if you lost a libel suit, they don't go and destroy every reel of microfiche, right? You can make addenda, you can make corrections, and you can retract through addenda, but never by erasure. And this is like so important for the integrity of information in a democratic society. Nobody can come and mess with the actual history of what happened, even if you decide later that part of it was wrong or needed to be revisited.
I have a question that's a little bit of off topic, but a couple episodes ago, we had Adrian Chen on, our mutual friend. I think actually the first time we met was when Adrian was staying at your place in LA. He had written about Bitcoin around the same time that you did. And he's a vicious no-coiner.
I believe he was described on Twitter this week as patient zero of the no-coiner movement.
Wait a second. Does he not have his Doge coins anymore? I know
he did confess at the end that he had some Doge coins.
Yeah,
but he tried to play it off like he didn't mean to get them.
Yeah.
Take us back to that moment in 2013 when you're writing about this before. I think many, many people ever wrote about it. Like, what was interesting about it to you? And more importantly, did you buy at a low price?
I did buy at a low price. I bought my first Bitcoin for $64, I think. It was either 64 or 67, I forget. It was exciting, and I wanted to know what I was talking about. I don't really think that you can describe it adequately until you, like, you know, go do it. And I had at first intended to buy at, like, you know, $7, but then there was, like, this huge scandal at Dwolla, and it crashed. And I loved the technology. You know, I loved the theory of it. And, I mean, even when it was at $7, I ran across some of my early notes about it, and I thought, you know, this will be fine. Let me try it. And I wrote at $7, you know, I put a copy of a chart up and I said, you know, I kind of feel like the fast money is, that period is over. But I'm going to try and buy some anyway, you know. And then I just kind of, for a little flutter, you know, I bought some in, I think 2012, 2013, just so I would know what I was talking about, you know. And at that point, Matt Buchanan, who's also a friend of ours, had gone to the New Yorker blog, and he asked me, you know, it's a tech deal. He was running this blog called Elements, and which you're familiar with, Jay. And yeah. He said, what do you want to write about? And I'm like, oh, Bitcoin, most definitely. He's like, really? Like, that? Okay, whatever, lady. And I'm like, no, seriously, it's going to be a thing. And he's like, all right, go ahead. And so I wrote about it, and at that exact moment, there was a huge banking crisis in Cyprus. And the price had just jumped, you know, over $100 for the first time, like right around then. Or maybe it got to 60 or something like that. And 100 by the time we published. And I mean, it was really evident that, I mean, and this is one of the big things that cryptocurrency, I'm talking about the banking aspects of this technology, can do for people, is it's a way to move a store of value, you know, absent borders. It's just borderless, you know, sort of transmission of money. And we see every time that there's a banking crisis, like pretty much anywhere in the world, you'll see a spike in crypto prices. And it's very important for people to understand, right, that like the entire Bitcoin universe right now, I mean, at the current price, I don't know how many hundreds of billions it is, but it's not even $1 trillion. I mean, it's not even half a trillion. So
just getting started.
Yeah, the whole universe of crypto is really tiny compared to the fiat world. And so it just like cracks me up when people are saying, oh, Bitcoin's going to, you know, impact the markets. It can't. It's minute. I mean, we're at the absolute just infancy of this thing. By saying this, I don't mean that I think prices are going to go up or down. I have no idea. You know, we're in the Wild West now. But it's a very, very tiny universe even now. It's minute compared to, you know, Fiatlandia. So we got a long, long, long way to go.
Fiatlandia. I like that term.
Yeah. I mean, but like, you know, back in 2013, it was just really evident that this thing was useful, immediately useful, like in the currency markets. And, but I mean, even back then, I thought, you know, the holy grail of this thing is sort of like voting, you know, title. Like, if we'd had a blockchain-based system of figuring out who owned a house, which would be really fairly trivial for a government to implement, we would not have had the 2008 crisis. That would not be possible. You would not be able to do robo-signing or falsification of chain of title or any of that sort of shit that they, shenanigans that the banks got up to in the run-up to that. So it's useful. Now, there are constituencies that are, you know, have agendas that are arrayed against the adoption of these technologies. But I mean, I think some kind of adoption of them is almost inevitable. There's going to be a power struggle like there always is for entrenched interests to keep hold of their power. But still, the usefulness of it is such that it's so many different things, you know, supply chain, cold chain, it's just endless, you know.
I have a question there. You're different than a lot of the guests we have on the show, because a lot of your interest in the blockchain seems like it's in supporting rather than deconstructing civil society. So you're interested in journalism, things like title and voting. A lot of people that we've talked to on the show believe that decentralization technology will sort of destroy the state. And I also understand, while I don't agree with that perspective, I do understand that how cryptocurrencies could lower tax collection and that kind of stuff. Do you see decentralization as a threat to the same stuff that you're kind of trying to support also?
I think that blockchain technology is a value neutral tool. It's like, It's like saying, you know, is a knife good or bad? The answer is yes. You know, depending on what your political goals are. I mean, you know, we see a lot of soi-disant libertarians and people like this involved in the space because they think that they'll be able to get away without paying taxes. I don't support that. Also, I think that they're vastly underestimating the power of the forces that are arrayed against that kind of use for this technology. When I first spoke with Gavin Andreessen about this, he told me that if the U.S. government were to speak to him and say, stop what you're doing, he would stop. Most serious people who have been involved in Bitcoin for any length of time are paying taxes on it, ordinary capital gains. We've seen that Coinbase was asked for information about sort of heavy users. It's simply not possible to hide this kind of activity from the government indefinitely.
Yeah, I think the cutoff for Coinbase was $20,000, which at this point is anyone who has two Bitcoin.
I know, but I mean, I have never understood what it is that the sort of Panama crowd or the Puerto Rico crowd, like, you know, what it is that they're intending for this world to look like. I mean, to me, like, what they're talking about sounds an awful lot like kind of Somalia or something.
Scorched earth is a term that has come up on the show a lot. The scorched earth vision of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I don't subscribe to that in any way, and I don't think it's realistic. And I think the players who think like that have neither the rhetorical force nor the brains to pull something like that off, frankly.
That's actually something that Aaron and I talk about quite a bit, and I don't think we fully agree on it, but I think we're closer than maybe us and like some of these Puerto Rico, as you say, Somali, you know, try to recreate Somalia, where they're like these sort of landed oligarch warlords of their own society, which is that, you know, the messaging around Bitcoin so often is from the original cypherpunks. It is from the libertarians who got in. A lot of it is about how we should no longer eat plants and only eat meat.
Yeah.
I mean, as somebody who is a journalist who has different politics than that, who, you know, just from the first few minutes, I think from talking to you, I think anyone can discern that you are very, very bullish on blockchain and Bitcoin in general. Like, do you think that there's a way to change that messaging? Because, like, we're not doing this podcast because of that. Actually, Aaron and I probably are closer to them than either of us will admit in polite company. But how do you change that messaging?
Jay, don't out me.
No, you've been outed.
I've literally devoted my life to instantiating what I think ought to be done with this. So I kind of think that's the way to do it. Show a good thing to do with it that works really well. I have absolutely no beef with, you know, scorched earth libertarians. I don't agree with them. I mean, I'm waiting to hear, like, you know, you know, would I want to live among these people? I mean, the answer is like, I'm extremely emphatic. No, I'm like I'm a harmless mom. I have no interest in this.
Do scorched earth libertarians even want to live with other scorched earth libertarians? I feel like I sort of agree with libertarianism, but I want to live with like a bunch of warm hearted, empathetic people.
Right. That's kind of a hard circle to square there, as far as I can make out. I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. I haven't spent enough. I mean, I've spent a lot of time with these people. I've been to blockchain conferences, and I just feel like they're, a lot of them are just raving maniacs, you know, who like have like no brains at all. I mean, they're really dumb. But I mean, that's just me. Go ahead, knock yourself out, son, you know, seasteading, whatever, you know.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense that there aren't a ton of people doing the kind of project you're doing yet in this world, because this world is not totally interested in these kind of projects. So I'm curious, what kind of reaction have you gotten from within the cryptocurrency world to Civil?
Well, there's been an enormous change in the last 6 months. And also, I disagree. Like, there's the activity around this thing is just, it's like being inside a volcano. It's like, it reminds me so much. I mean, you've heard this a million times. It's like the dawning of the internet, where people had all these insane ideas and you really could not tell which of them would have legs, you know, and some of them did. But in the last 6 months, I have gone from, you know, sort of asking people, well, have you ever heard of Bitcoin, you know? And now people are like calling me, like my best friend, my best girlfriend, who's like not a computer guy, called me 2 weeks ago and said, like, Randy, her husband, like, Randy wants to buy cryptocurrency and he wants to talk to you. I'm like, Randy, like, I mean, he barely knows how to use email. I'm like, he's going to need to come over. This is like a 2-bottle of wine conversation. I'll try and help him. But like, it's completely changed. And the other thing is, I was so surprised myself to find, you know, because I was working on other things when this came up after the election. I thought, I got to change my life. I mean, that's really what happened here, you know. After the election, I just felt so complicit in the bullshit materialism. And I had been sold this incremental bill of goods, you know. I mean, believe me, compared to, you know, the sort of harmless mom to the left of centrist that I used to be, I'm like now relatively like this like raging pinko. I actually think we just need a new book, you know. I don't want any more 19th century books. I want a new book that tells people of really strong leftist convictions how we're going to rearrange society in a more equitable and egalitarian way. I really feel strongly about this. And so anyway, I thought, I'm going to do something that I really believe in. And that's kind of how I wound up here. But anyway, in the last 6 months, I discovered so much stuff that I didn't know about. You know, how many resources the banks have put into this now, IBM's work, you know, on supply chain. It's like there's like a lot of energy going into this that I had absolutely no idea about when I kind of got back into it last summer.
That's something I'm also interested in, which is that to me, it seems like, look, the far right, obviously, and members of the actual alt-right are very into Bitcoin and also this sort of idea of anarcho-capitalism. The original cypherpunks, who I don't think would have politics like you, but it also seems like some of the old Occupy crowd and some of the people who are very against centralized banking, who were very angry about the 2008 bailouts, like, you know, anyone, which is at this point, 80% of the country is angry about the 2008 bailouts. And half of the political conversation is about that on either side. But I would say that in terms of actual interest, the right is far more interested in crypto than the left. How do you get sort of the left more engaged in this and show them, hey, look, I know that when you go online that all you see is a bunch of people shit posting Pepe memes, but maybe this is good for us. Like, how do you start that conversation?
I wonder, you know, I mean, I'm sure you guys are familiar with Rachel Rosenfeld's Bail Block project. I mean, yeah. It seems to me like it's not so much that the right is more interested than the left. It's just that the right is noisier than the left, and they have nothing better to do. I mean, I feel like the rest of us are doing stuff that's going to interest people and be cool and make money. I'm like dead into this thing. I mean, I'm so into it. Here's these guys, they came to me and said, do your dream publication and we'll stake you, you know, and it's going to be published on a blockchain. And of course I like completely jumped at this. It was literally like what I'd been waiting for years, you know, to happen. And I'm in love with publication. I've hired some amazing people. It's going to be a beautiful thing. But I keep telling my staff, you know, it's like, I love this. I love Popula. I'm going to crawl on broken glass for Popula. I care about Popula less than I care about this platform. Because, you know, I'm into this because of what happened to DNA Info. I'm into it because of what happened to Gawker. I'm into it because, you know, I see the Peter Thiels of the world getting too much power. And this is a real way of countering that. So I feel like the way to start the conversation is by demonstrating in real life what it can do. And we're going to do that.
For the listeners who are unfamiliar with Peter Thiel, Gawker, DNA Info, can you just give us a refresher and just how, you know, how this is sort of a solution to this in your mind?
The listeners will likely be familiar with the Hulk Hogan trial that concluded in 2016, I guess, where Gawker was basically brought down by this washed-up wrestler and the blurry excerpt of a sex tape. Well, I covered that trial. I was in St. Petersburg when that whole thing went down. And when we were all writing about it and talking about it, none of us understood that Hogan had been bankrolled by a billionaire named Peter Thiel who, like, just hated Gawker. He claimed that he hated Gawker because they had outed him. But I actually don't believe that because it was kind of an open secret in Silicon Valley. I think he hated Gawker because they mocked him relentlessly at ValleyWag and effectively. And he could shut them up with money. And that's what happened. And it's a real travesty and a complete bastardization of the courts and a failure to protect the First Amendment that had a huge effect on me. So if Gawker had published to the civil blockchain, it would be impossible for Peter Thiel to shut them off, ever. Whoever had access to that blockchain would always be able to read those articles. And kind of like where that thing ended up is the archive of Gawker is currently still in the disposition of bankruptcy court. It was put up for bid. Peter Thiel bid for it, and there's a wide suspicion that his intention is to erase the archive and remove it from public view. And even the parts of the archive that reside at places like the Internet Archive's Wayback Machine are at risk because the Wayback Machine has hitherto quite often honored takedown requests from rights holders. So if Thiel should succeed in, you know, making the highest bid and the bankruptcy court decides to hand the archive over to him, he may well go to the Internet Archive and say, erase this. And, you know, there's a possibility that they might do that. So I'm deeply, deeply committed to seeing to it that that cannot happen, that the information that people need in a democratic society should remain available to them and never, ever be able to be threatened by the will of one rich person.
Ironically, Peter Thiel is a massive Bitcoin whale, so he's going to win either way if the decentralization happens. But at least the information would stay up.
I don't care how much money he has. I just don't think he should be able to shut anybody up.
Agreed.
Ever.
Agreed. So is Civil an ICO?
The token launch is due to happen like within very few months from now. I mean, at the maximum, it could be weeks to months from now. Yeah.
How can Jay and I get some?
Well, the token is called CVL. You could buy it like you could buy any type of ERC-20 token.
Well, so I think that the idea of publishing to the blockchain, I think that people can understand that if they understand the blockchain, but like what does that actually look like? How do you publish an article to the blockchain?
On the Ethereum network, there's like almost like a notes field, I guess. I understand this really imperfectly, so please forgive me, like people who know more than I do, but my understanding is that
I think it's pretty safe to say that everyone understands Ethereum pretty incompletely.
Yeah.
So you're in good company.
Anyone who corrects you will probably be wrong. So okay. Don't worry about it. So yes, please continue.
So please get in touch with me if I mess this up. But I think it's basically like a notes field in a database that you can put text in. And so what we will be doing at Popula is we'll be paying in regular gas, which is what we call Ether, right? You guys know about that part.
Yeah, yeah.
We'd be paying a small amount of gas to publish to that field, all the text. We won't be able to afford to do video or audio at first. you know, until the technology catches up with us. But all the text that we publish will be published onto those fields. So it will be on the whole Ethereum network. And then as far as what our publication will look like, it will just be a website that is published using the civil platform that lives on the Ethereum blockchain, like any other Ethereum project.
Does that mean that the website actually reads directly from the Ethereum blockchain, or are these two different copies for the
web? It's two different copies.
Okay.
Okay, so it's not like I have to download a D app to read this. Like I can
absolutely
just
type not. In oh yeah,
it's not. It's not only available in Toshi's.
Popula.com, my friends. Popula. Okay.
Okay, so there's two expenses you have then. You have the expense of paying the writer, and then you have the expense of paying the gas to add their work to the blockchain.
Right.
How is that being funded?
Civil is funded by the group that started the company went, you know, they put their own money in it, and then they went to Consensus, which you guys probably know is the largest Ethereum developer in the world now. And they're based, they've got offices in Brooklyn, and it's where Joe Lubin, who is like, I think the number seven person to join Ethereum, is one of the founders, or is the founder, I guess, of Consensus. So when the Civil CEO, Matthew Iles, young guy, super bright, went to Consensus and told him what he wanted to do and please build, you know, our token launch and build our platform. Consensus invested $5 million in the company. They own a large stake in it. So there's, and this is before the token launch, there's a lot of millions of dollars in this project. So after the token launch, they're going to raise more money. And part of that money is to stake a number of newsrooms that they're calling the first fleet, of which Popula is the first. There's a number of others. A few of them have been announced. One of them is Sledge, that I really love. This guy, David Moore, who used to do Open Congress. I mean, this is by way of telling you, there's a really broad range of politics like in this project. Sledge follows money in politics. There's a lot of kind of cross-pollination that I think is going to happen. Some of the XDNA are involved in this. There's a publication called Block Club Chicago that's being headed by Seamus Toomey in Chicago, X of DNA. Some just wonderful people that, I mean, they're just so freaking funny and great, and who are going to also be publishing on Civil. And there's a number of others that I can't tell you about yet, but really exciting, loads of publications. And so we've been offered the opportunity to be staked, you know, to start these things off. And then, you know, obviously for some period of time. And then we're going to do subscription-based publications. There's people who are founding nonprofits. Block Club Chicago, they put up a Kickstarter. They were trying to raise $25,000. On the second day, I haven't checked to see where it was going. It was a 30-day Kickstarter. On the second day that I went to check, they'd raised $125,000 because, you know, people really love DNA in Chicago so much, and they were so sad to lose it that, like, there was just this outpouring of support from their, you know, existing readership.
Just for the listeners who aren't up on all the news and publishing, DNA Info was a local news site that had different offices in different places, different sites, and it all got shut down when their owner decided that he didn't want to be in the publishing business anymore. This is another case where like an archive of information was taken down.
If let's say me and Jay buy the CVL token, which we definitely will, because we'll buy. If you've seen some of the things we buy, we definitely will buy CVL. What does that get us? Like, what does it mean that I send you some Ethereum and you send back a CVL token?
Okay, so you guys know about Ethereum-based tokens like Augur and all these other.
Yeah.
Okay, so these tokens are based on a use case that is separate from Ethereum proper, all of them.
For people listening, Augur is a prediction market. I think we talked about it in episode 5, Coin Talk. Go check that out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm a fan of prediction markets. But anyway, and I love gambling. You know, I mean, I'm all over it. I just, you know, I think it's
you and us both.
I think it's great. Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, you know, you only risk as much as you can afford to lose. Don't go crazy, but it's Fine.
And none of this is investment advice. All right.
Yeah.
So what do we get for a civil token?
You get a stake in the future of independent publishing protected by the blockchain.
And what does it mean by a stake? Like, how do we get a stake in it? Because there's all this confusion, I think, in ICOs. We talked about this earlier in the episode, which is that everyone kind of assumes that this is like investing in a startup and that you get shares and that's what the ICO is. But that oftentimes is very not true.
It's so giantly not true. Like,
what does the stake mean?
It's not an ownership. It's nothing like stock or equities at all. I think there's 100 million civil being issued, and I think around half of those will be sold in the token launch. I always tell people to think of it more like, kind of like, you know, Skype credit or airline miles, something like that, where it enables you to participate in the underlying economy. You can buy it in the same place where you can buy cryptocurrency. You know, I've been talking about archives because it's the easiest thing for people to understand, but really, civil is an entire economy for journalism. One of the things that I'm really excited about doing is micro-tipping. I've got a lot of plans for this. You know, we haven't been able to micro-tip journalists. We've had all these different attempts, like Flatter, and, you know, there's been millions of them, where if you like an article or you like, you know, a writer, you can subscribe to that person and you can give them micro tips. Now, in fiat, it's quite difficult to do that because processing payments is very expensive on Visa, PayPal, existing systems like this. But in a cryptocurrency type token economy, like what Civil is, it's very easy and cheap to be able to tip, like, you know, a quarter or something like that. So what I'm hoping we'll be able to do, and what I think we'll be able to do, is offer subscribers to Popula the opportunity to support the kind of writing they like. I'm trying to make it so that subscribers only can do comments, and it will cost some civil to comment. That's a way by which we can discourage trolls and Cambridge's Analytica and people like this. Like, if it costs you 10 cents to comment, you might do it. You'd wait until you had something valuable to say. But that's going to make it difficult if you have to go through a separate subscription process and actually pay something. It's going to make it way less attractive to, like, do whatever it is that they did at the Internet Research Agency. You're putting up some walls to that kind of activity, and you're also making it a lot easier to detect.
So in a way, the CVL token is the native currency of the civil system. So I could use it for applications, everything from subscribing to a publication, to tipping an author, to buying the right to comment.
Exactly. This is what we consider to be the principal use of civil tokens. This is why we're doing this.
And will civil tokens be like Augur, where they'll be on like Bittrex at some point, and I'll be able to swap them for Bitcoin and Ethereum and all kinds of stuff?
Yeah, I don't know exactly on which exchanges yet, but it will definitely be on major exchanges so that you'll be able to do these things. But I mean, again, you know, the token exists so that we can make the economy. That's what it's for. I mean, we were talking before about, you know, how do you change the conversation around blockchain technology? This is how. You know, you make a thing that you need it, you know. Just exactly wow. Like, you know, when airline miles came into being, you could buy plane tickets with fiat, right? Like, you could buy a plane ticket. There's nothing wrong with that. But when this loyalty programs came into existence, it just really altered how that economy operated, and you were able to make deals with credit card companies where, like, you could give miles for those, and you'd, like, it's kind of like a currency. I remember there was, like, a divorce case years and years back where, like, the principal asset in this couple's marriage was their airline miles. Like, they had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of miles, and the divorce hinged on the disposition of this. It was like an asset. So you can consider it an asset, but really what it's for is to enable a kind of commerce.
Maria, you and I both have been journalists for a while, and we know that there are many terrible things about being a journalist, including the constant existential dread and, you know, the sense of worthlessness. However, One of the worst things is trying to get paid for the things that you write. And oftentimes these are very trivial amounts to anyone who actually has money. But to journalists, they're a big deal. Trying to get paid by any company, however reputable, is very difficult. For the writers out there, for even people who want to do things like start their own blogs, like how does Civil change the economy of writing and journalism?
I'm really excited about this because I think we can be instantiating a new payment model for this profession. All of us have, or all of us who have some kind of career of any length and success in this business, have pieces that have been put on college syllabi, or they're in books, or people are still referring to them, you know, years later in other magazine pieces. Now, we don't get paid for that. There's no such thing as a royalty system in the journalism industry. But on Civil, you're going to be able to gather micro tips for as long as that piece is up. So when you think about it, those really successful pieces that are still seeing, like, you know, thousands of readers every year, I mean, even 10 years later, if you consider a successful journalism career where you could stack those things up and they can still be gathering money for you, and that's exactly what I'm doing here, it's possible to envision making an actual living at this, you know, without like freaking out all the time, as you so pithily suggest.
I have a follow-up question. This is a tough question, and I'm playing the tough journalism skeptic here. So I worked on a project called Readability several years back.
I remember that.
Which is somewhat similar to like the Flatter system mm-hmm. that you described. And all of these kind of assume this idea that readers either want to tip journalists or want to pay a monthly fee, which gets divvied among journalists, some form of that. And what I always notice as a person who's not a journalist, but hangs out with a lot of journalists and is invested in the journalism world, is that there's always a lot of creative solutions to getting journalists paid. There's always a lot of supply on the journalism saving ideas front, but there isn't necessarily the same demand from readers and consumers to interact with that kind of a system. A lot of times when I hear, oh, this is going to save journalism, it feels like it's the same 1,000 people who are participating on the reader side. I mean, you can see that in, you know, even some of the venerable publications that really have names, you know, their subscription lists are under 10,000. So I guess I'm wondering, like, how does an idea like this go mainstream, and how does it break out of that same 1,000 people who donate to N+1 and the Paris Review and are really invested in journalism?
I think we're in a very different world from the world that existed when Readability came out. And by the way, I remember that Readability gathered a lot of money that you guys wound up having to donate, right?
I was not a part of that.
So
that was after I had already left.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that. After the election, I think it became really evident to people that leaving their information in the hands of untrustworthy entities like Facebook and the platform companies in general, Google, was dangerous. And I don't think that that's a difficult case to make in this world. You see the results of this new skepticism in the increased subscription rates at every major publication in this country. I mean, another difference that's like worth pointing to in this environment between what Popula is doing or like what Block Club Chicago is doing is the native platform of Civil. It's not like, you know, in the case of Readability, you had to share the platform where the publication took place was like, say, the New York Times or whatever other publication. As worthy as that idea was, and I was quite interested in it at the time and I thought it was great, it was too diffuse a universe to sort of embrace with one idea like that. I mean, I think about Readability and Flatter and other sort of efforts like this a lot, you know, in designing what we're doing here. I think the time is right, the climate is right. We have the example of efforts like yours before us. And, I mean, we just have to keep trying because the cost is too high not to. We may not have the hugest readership to start with, but we are going to demonstrate what's possible. And if it, you know, turns out to be the rough draft of another effort that comes later, I'll be happy.
I think these are all rough drafts at this point. We can assume that anything that's on the blockchain is a rough draft at this point, right?
I don't know, man. Everything about it has surprised me or shocked me. I just, every time I think I have any idea what's going to happen next, I just am wrong.
Where can people who would like to like read more about Civil and understand this and find Popula find it?
Popula.com. You can sign up for our mailing list. Please write to me. My email is open, maria@popula.com. Follow me at Maria Bustillos on Twitter. I love Twitter. So yeah, I'm around. And Civil's around. Joincivil.com. And yeah, there's a lot out there that you can read about us.
Okay, last question. So you told us you bought some Bitcoin at, what was it, 60?
It was either 64 or 67, I don't remember.
64 yeah. Or 67. What's in your bag right now? Are you an altcoin speculator? Are you deep on the ERC-20 tokens?
Let me see. I have some Bitcoin still. I sold a lot of it, okay. I mean, my husband was like, oh my God, this thing is worth $500. I like SNT, I like Status, I like the developers there. And
I don't know what that project is.
Status Network. Oh, it's very interesting. Look into it.
You heard it here first. Yeah. Coin Talk.
And it's some Ethereum. I think that's all I've got right now.
I'll say that I think my understanding of these ERC-20 utility tokens is really going to change when I actually use one.
Yes.
Like, I guess Augur is maybe launching soon. Like, I've heard so much about them, but I've never actually done the thing you're describing. And in the same way that I think Bitcoin's really different when you actually have some versus when you talk about it, mm-hmm. I think ERC-20 is going to be the same way.
I think that moment is coming soon. And
yeah.
Very.
This is a very interesting project. I don't think just to those of us who are in the journalism world, like you said, anyone who's interested in information security or bad actors, I think that this is going to be super compelling to. And, you know, it seems like you guys have brought on a lot of very interesting people, both from our world and also the sort of crypto, our world being journalists and also the crypto world. So we're excited to see what happens.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'd love to have you back on like when the CVL token launches, maybe like, and maybe we could like tip you on air or something.
Oh,
like
heck
that.
Yeah.
Like,
that'd be so cool.
I want to do all this stuff, and I feel like mm-hmm. it's all coming. When does the token go on sale again?
It's the announcement is like in a matter of days. So
okay,
watch
so
this
soon.
Space. Yeah, it's really happening. I'm like, you know, like you know, yeah,
yeah.
Get on MetaMask,
are you,
man.
Are you gonna get a bunch of Civil as like part of having a Civil thing? Like, are you a stakeholder now in Civil?
You guys know I like to roll the dice. I've been working for only Civil. I've been working for only Civil since the summer.
Thank you, Maria.
Thanks, Maria.
We'll talk to you soon.
Bye. Another Coin Talk in the books. Thanks to my co-host, Jay Kang. Thanks to our guest, Maria Bustillos. Thanks to our editor, James Nicholson. We are, of course, produced in partnership with Medium. You can find all the episodes at medium.com/cointalk, including transcripts, should you care to read rather than listen to the show. If you'd like to get in touch, perhaps you are a sponsor trying to push a crypto product of some kind. We've been hearing from you and appreciating it. It's hi@cointalk.show. Send us questions for our mailbag. Send us comments. We appreciate it all. And hey, maybe rate us on iTunes. We'd appreciate it. Okay, we will see you very soon.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Monday, February 19th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $11,159.